Senate Health and Human Services Committee for Wednesday, March 16th. We have a number of bills this morning that we are going to try to hear. If we are not successful in getting through them all, we will recess and meet again this evening at 6 o'clock. 7 o'clock, I'm advised. We would like to get started right away. We do have a quorum, and before we do anything else, we did hear a bill in committee a couple of days ago, Senator Berglund's bill, that we laid over, and we would like to, I believe, do something with that, and I'm going to ask Senator Berglund to recognize you to tell us what you'd like to do.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a motion that Senate File 348, that's the PCA bill we heard earlier this week, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. The very small savings in the bill can be tracked in Senator Hand's budget, but the department needs a couple of months lead time to implement this PCA change, and so we'd like to have the bill go separately so that they would have enough time to do that work.
Does everybody understand the motion? I appreciate Senator Berglund's motion. She has the view that our bill may get tied up in negotiations with the governor. I suppose that's possible.
Well, there might be several budget bills also. Who knows?
And it might get complicated. So I support the motion. And any other discussions? All in favor? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you.
Motion is passed, and the bill will be referred to finance. Thank you, Senator Berglund. Senator Vandeveer, are you ready to take up Senate File 254?
Ready, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for being here.
Move the bill.
I'm sorry, did you want to move the bill?
If somebody could.
Senator Nino.
I will move the bill, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Nienau moves Senate File 254. All in favor say aye. I don't have to vote on it yet, do we? You do not want to vote. We just want to have it in front of us. All right. We have the bill in front of us. Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 254 is about reform and options, providing options for adult family.
Could I ask you, Senator Vandeveer, just to bring the microphone close? We have trouble with the recording, and so please try to get that close as you can. Thank you.
Is this better?
Much better.
Thank you. Senate File 254 is about reform and options for people that need the adult day family daycare services, and here to explain the bill is Mary Johnson.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Johnson.
Could you bring the microphone close?
Closer.
It was Mary Johnson.
Yes, I am a registered nurse. And Mr. Chair, I have been providing family adult day services for approximately 18 years, and it's family adult day services. We have worked back and forth with the department to develop the family model for day services for elderly and handicapped individuals. Approximately 2 years ago, we had worked out where we would be working with the department, and we would find a way to get reimbursement clearer on the CADI, CAC, and TBI waivers. We did not receive any correspondence with the Department of Human Services, so we pursued it ourselves. At that time, probably that was fall of 2010, they told us they were not going to pursue it, they were not interested, and that we would not be included in the new funding mechanism, which is the common service menu. So trying to resolve that with them, we decided that it was not going to be a very easy situation. We went to our representative and our senator, and they were kind enough to look at a way of resolving this quicker, clearer, and more concrete, and that is the law before you. Right now, we require a variance for people 18 to 55, and I want to clear up a misconception. We are not talking about people 24-hour care. We are talking about people coming to our home that are living in their family home or with a loved one. So they come to our home for the care during the day, and it is a structured day with activities and outings and programs, just as a commercial setting. Now, the commercial setting or the institutional model, in at least in our area, the only other option they have for day services for the handicapped and elderly is in a nursing home. So if you didn't have our program, the only facility that they would have to choose from would be the nursing home to stay the day there. Obviously, it's someone's choice. Currently, we are full with a waiting list, and I'd say probably 80% are between the age of 18 to 55. I would like to go on the record that we did not pursue this age group. They pursued us. They have come to us. Their family members have come to us. They are asking for a different choice. These are people that have tried day training and habitation and were not successful, have been in commercial day programs and have not cared for them. You have to understand some of those facilities are licensed up to 70 people or so. They want an additional resource for themselves. So that's why we would like to clear this up, make this variance easier to understand and have it an actual law. The other issue is the funding. When the common service menu comes in, we will be without the CAC, CADI, or TBI waivers.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Are there questions? Senator Vandeveer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from Anoka County Commissioner Rhonda Sivaraj is here, and she'd like to speak to the bill also.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rhonda Sivaraja. I'm Anoka County Commissioner, and it's S-I-V-A-R-A-J-A-H. In Anoka County, we have an adult foster home that also provides family adult daycare services within their home. And family adult daycare services are only covered under the elderly waiver and the alternative care programs for adult foster homes. That is not the case for facilities providing adult daycare services. Those services provided in a facility setting are paid for those between the ages of 18 and over under all of the waiver programs, so including the DD waiver, the TBI waiver, the CAC and CADI waivers. So in other words, the rules vary depending upon the setting in which the services are being provided in. You know, I would liken this to telling a family daycare provider, that an in-home daycare provider, that they can't provide services to children under the age of two. However, if they had a center, that they could provide to infants all the way up. Similar sort of situation. You know, the home can have persons under the age of 55 if they're granted a variance from the county on a case-by-case basis. Adds a great deal of bureaucracy and red tape to the system. Our county has routinely authorized variances for the Johnsons to have individuals under age 55 within their home. Now, there may be some that will tell you that this is going to open the floodgates. I would actually say that this is already a covered service that is being provided and allowed, again, in a facility. So it would not be opening the floodgates. Rather, it would be providing a choice for those who are seeking the service. Anoka County sees this legislation as a fair piece of legislation that provides people with choices as required by the Olmstead Supreme Court decision, which actually requires that states administer services, programs, and activities in the most integrated setting appropriate to meet the needs of individuals with disabilities. It also provides market competition and streamlines the bureaucracy. So I would ask for your support of this important legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there questions? Any questions?
Mr. Chair,
Senator
one more testifier I think would be invaluable. That is Maria Mortek.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
record. My name is Marie Mortek.
Could you spell that for us, please?
Sure. M-O-R-T-E-K.
Thank you.
And I am a board-certified psychiatric nurse with a master's degree in healthcare administration. I've been a psychiatric nurse inpatient for about 30 years at a local hospital, and I'm currently working as a consultant for Johnson's foster care as a behavioralist. I'm in support of this bill that supports options for family daycare. It's a distinctive care model, and it has an extraordinary ability to integrate people with special needs into our community. And this is very, very vital. I've personally observed how a family setting best enhances the quality of life for disabled people, especially those between ages 18 and 55. Their developmental needs and social needs are augmented in a family setting. Because of the daily opportunities for outings to the library, the YMCA, church services, they go for coffee, they've gone for to the local lakes to go fishing. These are services that are very unlikely in a facility setting. One of the residents at Johnson's told me when I spoke with her that she's the birthday coordinator. And she knows everybody's birthday, and she plans the party. And typically they go out to a restaurant and celebrate birthdays like a family does. And the reason that I bring this up is it's stark contrast to in an institution where people have personality traits that develop, such as learned helplessness, dependency, hopelessness, and other maladaptive behaviors. So the engagement in the family setting is what is truly beneficial. I've seen that the clients have hobbies that wouldn't be offered in facilities, such as gardening, building birdhouses, playing music, painting. There's a few that are really big-time Minnesota Twins fans, and they gather together and watch the games and have that social interaction. So certainly the type of high-quality, personalized care that are provided through a family setting is what I would want for a loved one of mine or myself. And my 30 years in working in a hospital has taught me on a regular basis that each of us is only an accident away from being a disabled adult ourselves. And so with that, I support this family setting. It's the type of care that disabled people who are so typically marginalized deserve.
Thank you, Ms. Mortek. Are there questions for the witness? Thank you. Senator Benavir, are there other witnesses that you have?
I believe that's all that I have at this time. Ellen Yope.
Ellen
Yope is here also.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Ellen Gilb, G-I-L-B as in boy. In 2000, my husband suffered a heart attack that resulted in a traumatic brain injury. He has been at home with me since 2001. In 2002, briefly, he was at the Johnson's daycare program under a variance. Something happened with the variance, and he could no longer stay there, being under 55. And I had to put him in a corporate setting. They took care of him, but since he's become legal, he is back in the Johnson's program, and I can just see the differences. He's more communicative. He initiates conversations. He's happier being in the family setting. It works for him. What I'm asking for is choices for the disabled and the caregivers who care. And the more choices that are available, the better for the individual to reach their full potential. A person that is developmentally disabled has different needs than a person with a traumatic brain injury. Even two people with traumatic brain injuries have different needs. So the more options that are available, the more they can reach their full potential. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gilb. Appreciate it. Senator Vanderveer, have you other testifiers?
No, I don't.
I do have one person on our list, Steve Larson, who would like to testify as well. Mr. Larson.
Good morning, Chairman Hann and committee members. I'm Steve Larson, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the ARC of Minnesota, which advocates for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I'm also here speaking on behalf of the Mental Health Network and NAMI Minnesota. I am a former foster care provider. My wife and I provided both children's and adult foster care, and so I want to say that I admire the work that all foster care providers do, and I think they're the backbone of our system in providing great services to people in the community. However, I think that the current system is working. We do have the opportunity for a variance, which was described here. That variance decision is made at the county level. And I think if there's any problems in the speed or how the variance is handled, then the counties have the opportunity to improve that process, to streamline it, to make it work. The challenge that we have is that we're looking at changing a rule that would impact 40,000 Minnesotans that are on waiver programs. A few months ago, at the beginning of the legislative session, TPT, along with Lutheran Social Services and the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, developed a DVD called Institutions to Independence. And one of our concerns that's highlighted in that DVD is 24-hour control. Formerly in institutions, people were under 24-hour control of the state, and there were many problems with that. So as a result of that concern, we developed the 24-hour rule, which has been in existence for the past 30 or 40 years. And the 24-hour rule is that no one provider provides both home services, residential services, and day services to an individual. And the purpose of that is so that there are more people involved in an individual's life in case there is anything that's going wrong that needs to be reported. So we are concerned about the health and safety of individuals with disabilities and the impact that this could have on their lives. We believe that if we're challenged here, the challenge is that we want to seek more employment situations for individuals with disabilities. They're greatly underemployed, and we're all challenged to enhance their opportunities to be employed and more involved in their communities. We think with the current challenging budget times, if we make this opportunity available to all 40,000 people on the waiver, it's a step backwards because if we run into difficulties with budgets for individuals, then many of them could be ended up being staying at home rather than seeking the employment and other opportunities to be involved in the community. We think the system is going to evolve and make greater opportunities and choice for individuals. In fact, we have legislation that we'll be reviewing in the next week and days that'll increase the self-direction opportunities for individuals. It'll increase opportunities for service coordination. And we're hopefully going to be proposing legislation that will develop a community-based quality assurance system that will rely on determining whether an organization gets their license based on whether they're achieving the outcomes that individuals want. When we have all of those things in place, then I think we can revisit this type of issue. But in the meantime, we don't want to make this type of opportunity available. So we believe the current system is working. It was described how it's working. If there's problems with getting the variance on the local level, which is a big issue here, we want decisions to be made on a local basis, then we should address those issues. So I would ask you to keep the current system in place and to not support this particular bill. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Are there questions? Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Larson, with this bill goes down to 18-year-olds, with, a young adult, 25, 30-year-old. In other words, in this bill, that individual, because they could be in the same house all the time, nobody's going to be, in other words, they may not have the same opportunities for employment type of things, which right now the goal is to try and give people as many options as they can, I presume. Is the concern primarily that they're not leaving the home in a certain case and that one provider, in effect, is 24 hours a day and may not be going out of their way to make sure they have employment opportunities or other. Is part of the goal making sure they're out of the building more, or is it partly to make sure they have more options, or is it tied together?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, it's all of the above. And as Mrs. Johnson reported, apparently in their particular home in this situation, they're saying that there isn't a person living there and staying for the day program. And that's fine, and I support the variance process that allows that opportunity. However, if we pass this legislation as currently written, there is the opportunity across the board for any adult foster care provider to apply for a day services license, and a person could reside there. There wouldn't be anything prohibiting that. That's why we think it should be made, the decision should be made on an individual basis with the team involved looking and applying for a variance if that's the appropriate thing to do. Yes, we're very concerned that we want to hold the standard high for our expectations for persons with disabilities, that we seek employment first, and that if employment isn't an option for all individuals, then that they have a life that's very inclusive in the community, and we have many examples of best practices in that area in the state.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Would you be able to remind me, under the current law, what happens with the 18 to 55-year-olds in relationship to this service that's different than the assumption of what's a, you know, 55 and older foster care place?
Mr. Larson.
And is it by law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, it's prohibited by law for 18 to 55-year-olds to receive day services in this type of setting, an adult foster care setting at this point in time. And so this...
Senator
Sharon.
Sorry, my question was not clear. I understand that.
Okay.
But I don't... What I want to know is... Are they allowed day treatment services in a different kind of a setting? And what is unique to that setting that is not in place in a license holder for 55 and older?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, thousands of our 18 to 55-year-olds with disabilities on all of our waiver programs, so we're not only talking people with developmental disabilities, but we're talking individuals with mental health diagnoses or physical disabilities, that type of thing, have the option. Many of them are employed, and many attend day training and habilitation programs. Some others have some unique services. So there is a great effort to get people out into the community and be as productive as possible, and all of those options are available to people. I'd have to ask for some help from other individuals in the audience as far as some of the programs for individuals with brain injury. They certainly have programs, and there's other day programs for individuals with a diagnosis of mental illness. And so there's just a great variety of services available.
Senator Sharon.
Make sure that I understand clearly that is there a license for foster daycare for those from 18 to 55? And within that license, is there a requirement for those providers to do something that's different for their clientele in regard to employment or day services? Is there foster care? And under that license, what expectation is there that is different than you would expect in the adult foster care?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, and perhaps I might need help from licensing if I'm not answering this question fully for Senator Sharon, but right now it is not allowed, as we discussed, for that. And there are, so in adult foster care, basically it's required that individual get out during the day. If there's no license or they haven't received a variance like we have had heard described in this particular situation.
Senator Sharon?
Is there someone that can answer my question more thoroughly?
Bob can. Mr. Johnson can.
Senator Vandeveer, is there somebody here?
Yeah, Mr. Johnson can answer that question.
And,
but they're a license holder.
Let me recognize, and Mr. Johnson, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Robert Johnson, and I've been working in family adult day services both as a provider and as an advocate for expanding these licenses for the past 20 years. There is a standard under Minnesota Statute 1245A 2.143, which we worked with the Department of Human Services on and it passed through the legislature in 2004, which provided a set of specific standards for family adult day services. Those standards do apply to persons between 18 and 55 with a variance. So it would be the same standards that apply for people 55 and over that would apply for 18 to 55. So there is a licensing, a specific license for family adult day services, and those standards cover the whole age range.
I understand that Mr. Kerber, the head of licensing, is here. I don't know if he wants to add anything to what Mr. Johnson just has stated, but if so, then looks like he's coming forward. So please join us, Mr. Kerber.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the director of the licensing division of the Department of Human Services, and I can try and answer licensing questions.
Well, I mean, let me ask Mr. Kerber, did you hear the question and did you hear the answer, and is there anything you'd like to add to what has already been said?
Mr. Chair and Senator Saran, if I understand the question, it's what are the other types of services that people would be expected to be receiving if they were not staying at home in their adult foster care setting? And most often that is supported employment or day training and rehabilitation. More and more often people are out in the workforce and working in settings and earning paychecks. That's probably the most common that we're aware of, and we do license day training and rehabilitation programs, and we license supported employment.
Senator Sharon.
I guess I have it in my head that if you're in adult foster care, you're staying overnight. Is that not true? I mean, you're living there.
Mr. Chair and
Mr. Kerber.
Saran, yes. What this model is kind of unique. A number of years ago, really as a result of the Johnson's services, and I don't think anybody here is debating the quality of the services they provide, the state policy has been that people with disabilities, who particularly younger people, have options available to them that are funded under the disability waivers. For elderly folks, and elderly at one point was defined as 60 and over, now it's unfortunately 55 and older, for those folks who can get services under the waiver, it made sense to provide family adult day services. And in order to make a go of it, it made some sense to expand the number of people that could receive those services in an adult foster care setting. And so while those settings could serve five people who reside there, the law allowed for them to bring in an additional three people during the day for those daytime services, and all of that would be funded under the elderly waiver. It's a good idea, and it makes a lot of sense. It came about in recent years that it also, in some cases, made sense for other individuals to receive those same services. And that's why the variance process was established in the law, so that at the local level, the county and the case manager and the family and everybody who's important in that person's life can make a decision about, ultimately decide the county deciding, whether or not it's in that person's best interest to not have one of these other arrangements, but rather to receive those daytime services in an adult foster care site. Important in that was that it wasn't the state making that decision. It's made at the local level. And I think we heard some about that it's sometimes maybe cumbersome at the local level. But that's where the decision was thought best to be made.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Kerber, do you know if it's very likely that we would be able to get a waiver for this type of situation? Do other states have waivers so they're able to do this, or is this kind of something that's not very likely to happen even if we pass this bill?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I really don't think I can answer that. I think there are some other people from the department who are more familiar with the waiver process and what's consistent with federal direction today on whether we ought to be encouraging other types of community involvement.
Mr. Chairman, maybe at the appropriate time we could ask those people to come up.
Sir Berglund, I I think we can get different opinions. I've heard varying opinions on the possibilities of waivers and depending on what they are. I guess some people have more optimistic opinions than others. But Senator Sharon, were you?
Well, I just before he left, I would like to ask more questions from the licensing division. So it's up to you, whatever.
Well, and members, I don't want to prohibit questioning. I want to allow everybody to get the opportunity to understand what we're doing. But we do have another person testifying. If we need to, we can bring Mr. Kerber back, if that's all right. You want to ask one of Mr. Kerber, would you please come back and let Senator Sharon ask her question? Senator Sharon.
Thank you. My questions really are to grasp what it is we're doing here. So I'm going to draw the conclusion then that the three extra people that can come in for day services in the adult foster care would be expanded now to include people 18 and above. But there's nothing in that that... standards that we've been talking about that require that the foster care person, they're going to be doing that. They're going to be in the foster home instead of engaged in these other opportunities, or is there a if there's a waiver at the county level, do they require the foster placement to engage their client in those additional programs?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I think I'm understanding your question. If somebody is going to be getting a waiver so that they can either stay home or in this case be younger than age 55 or be somebody with developmental disabilities or somebody with serious and persistent mental illness, and they are in fact going to this adult day, they're going to this foster home to receive those day services, they would be licensed as a family adult day services provider. And as such, they would be meeting the requirements that Mr. Johnson talked about. So that the services that they provide during the day fall under a separate set of regulations than the regulations that apply to the residential component of the adult foster care. So there's two different, under the current law, there's two different licenses actually. We can print them on the same document, but there's two different services that that provider is licensed to provide. There are about 4,800 adult foster care providers. I think there are 13 or so in the state who have this second license to provide adult day services.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, on that, though, but that adult day service in the foster home, is it required or would it be required that they do provide the employment opportunities and those things? Or would it just be the same things they're currently providing for the over 55 people who may not be looking for employment? That may not be the goal in those cases.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, I think this would be an alternative to that employment arrangement.
Would not be included.
That's correct. This would be a service provided at that home during the day. And that's the issue that Mr. Larson was talking about.
Senator Vanderveer. Are there other testifiers?
Yeah,
I know there was someone that had just walked up to speak after Mr. Kerber left. Maybe if
Mr. Chairman, if we could get my question answered.
Senator Berglund. Yes. Let's hear from. Please welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Heidi Hamilton from the Disability Services Division at DHS, and I'm here to address Senator Berglund's question.
Please, Ms. Hamilton.
I can't speak to whether or not the federal government will or will not approve a waiver amendment, but what I do know is over the past few years, they have increased the standards that the state needs to apply to all of our services to assure that there's consistent standards across the state for all of our waiver services. And so if we were to add a new service, we would have to assure that there would be consistency across the state, that there would be, especially if we were to eliminate the variance process, we need to assure at the statewide level that all of the health and safety standards are met for the people both living at the foster care and coming in during the day. So we would need to evaluate whether the current standards in place are appropriate or whether there needs to be additional standards.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, part of my question was whether do you know if any other state has ever tried to get one of these waivers or if any state has gotten one?
Ms. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I do not know that. All I know is that we have it under the elderly waiver in Minnesota. But I don't know about other states.
Ms. Hamilton, may I ask you, you're describing that we are operating under a federal rule or a federal mandate or whatever the right appropriate description might be. How necessary is that? If we didn't have that, would your practices in your department suddenly become less good? Would they become more, more likely that they would lead to bad results? Are these federal requirements critical to the operation of your department, that if you didn't have them, that you would be lost or without direct? I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of what your, and I understand this is just maybe your opinion. I'm not asking for a policy statement on the part of the department, but how critical is it that you have those guidelines? What if they weren't there? What would it do? Would it affect your department in some way, and how would it affect it?
Mr. Chair, the federal government, when we attempted to renew one of our waiver plans in 2008, stated that we were out of compliance with federal law. And this impacted all five of our waiver programs. And so we receive billions of dollars from the federal government to support individuals with disabilities and seniors. And if we did not come into compliance with the federal requirements, then we would risk that.
And those things that you were doing, were those bad things that the federal government said we were out of compliance with, or were they good things?
They were inconsistent across the state, and that's what they said we were out of compliance.
All right, and Ms. Hamilton, I understand they're inconsistent, but inconsistent doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't good. We're talking about allowing for inconsistency through waiver processes at the county level. We recognize that you need some flexibility. So my question is, on balance, those programs, as you understood them, were they good programs? And should they have been allowed to continue, in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, some of the counties did have good programs, good standards for the providers, and some of them had less than good. So,
let me just ask you this. The federal money that they said they were going to take away, where did that money come from?
Mr. Chair, it comes from the federal match that we get for our...
And Ms. Hamilton, where does the federal match money come from?
I don't know the answer to that.
I'm just asking Ms. Hamilton, if it's not true that it's from the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota, at least in part, through our taxes, it goes to Washington, and then they give us some of it back, and then they tell us we can or can't do the things that... And as you said, some of the things that you're talking about in this example you thought may have been good, may have not been. But the heart of my question is, does the department feel capable of governing that without the assistance of the federal government?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to that further.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Appreciate it. Senator Vandiver, do you have other
Mr. Chair, testifiers? It sounds like the department's uncertain as to whether it can capably handle that.
Senator, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say that. I don't want to put Ms. Hamilton in a bad spot. She's probably not the right person to try to put the department on the record for how they feel about
this. I have a 24-hour rule, too, and that I don't say anything when I get mad, but for 24 hours when I hear something aggravates me. But Mr. Johnson would like a brief response, if he could, to
Mr. Johnson.
Robert Johnson again. Mr. Chair, I would like to address at least the question that comes up about a 24-hour rule and 24-hour care and double billing billing for two services within a 24-hour period, that would be akin to accusing us of Medicare fraud. That cannot happen in the current system. You cannot bill for family adult day services or adult daycare and family adult or adult foster care services, period. People that come to our day program are from out in the community. We currently do not have anybody living with us that participates in our day program. They are more than welcome to participate in a day training and habilitation program. They are more than willing to participate in a structured day program or any of the other two employment programs available. There is a whole population of disabled individuals we're forgetting here, and those are people who will never get back to gainful employment. I don't want to be the judge on that, but I've got 20 years of experience seeing how those individuals and those family members that come to us for help in day services, when those options don't work, the state of Minnesota, in conjunction with the federal government, paid $184 million last year for day training and habilitative services. If you were to take all those individuals and put them in an adult day care model, that amount would be $15 million. I would submit to you that by having this alternative, that we would, one, be able to serve people with greater choice that probably could not be well in another setting, and that we could save a lot of money by just having the choice. We do not demand anybody come to this program. We're not saying that one program should not exist above another. We just want to have this as a viable option. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think that I'll close my comments.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And members, there is a fiscal note included with your material. It does show a cost. I just want to point out on page 2, it's one-time administrative costs showing up in fiscal year 12. And just want to point out, the costs are to develop the federal waiver amendment, coordinate efforts across the department and for a waiver, submit the waiver to CMS, responding to federal inquiries and making appropriate adjustments to the request, develop additional standards. So my point is there is some cost to this that we would likely take into consideration if we included this in our budget. But it does seem to me to be a cost that at least part of it is really not very productive, in my opinion. But are there any other questions for Senator Vanderveer before Senator Berglund?
Well, and Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm all in favor of asking for waivers, but I think when we do so, if we think it's a good idea to get the waiver to start with, then we should have some idea whether it's likely or not. Because otherwise, if it's not very likely, we're just wasting our money.
And Senator Berglund, I don't disagree. I think that we do have this process. I object to the process. I think it is wrong-headed. I don't think that the people that we have working in our department are any less capable than the people in Washington, D.C. to decide how well these programs work. And it's very frustrating to have to go through and spend money and time to seek permission from an agency far away to decide whether or not what we believe here. We might believe it's a good thing, and if we pass a bill and say we want to do this and we would like to do it except for this federal thing, but I take your point that they do have this process, and it does mean that sometimes things that we want to do we're not able to do. I agree. But did you have another comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do think we just need to keep things in perspective, and that is, you know, since the federal government is spending half or more, in many states more than half of the money, they do have a right to establish kind of more uniform standards across the country so that people with disabilities or people who are elderly or people who are in our TANF program can expect more similar results with the money than otherwise would happen.
Thank you. Senator Marty, you had a question.
Mr. Chairman, I don't see the fiscal note as a big issue here. It's, and I'm not trying to get into the federal waivers or no federal waivers, whether it's required or not. I want to know, is this a good idea? And why, Senator Vanderveer, why the local waiver that they can get is not an appropriate way? I mean, I hear from ARC of Minnesota that they're saying this may be taking away options for young adults, and maybe it's appropriate for some of them to be in these settings. But why would we just say for all 40,000 of them, why can't we just do what we're doing with the local waivers? I mean, you have a county commissioner here. Why can't they just provide the waiver as a county rather than change the law for everybody, in which case it sounds like a lot of folks may not be getting the opportunities that we're paying for right now, and presumably we'd be paying for just a different setting. And I guess I think a 25-year-old may have different needs than a 65-year-old. And I guess that's the question I'm not getting, is why we should change it for everyone when they can get a local waiver, it sounds like, if they're appropriate people for this.
Senator Vanderveer, did you respond?
And Senator Marty, thank you. That's a good question. Remember, this is just an option. There is no requirement that they do it. But Mr. Johnson also is dying to jump in here with an answer.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, the problem is with all the work going on up at the department with common services menu, with different standardized payment structures and standards across the state, standardizing services across the state, that waiver process will no longer be valid if these initiatives go through. We have repeatedly requested to be involved in the common services menu work groups. And as a matter of fact, Senator Marty, I think I called your office 2 years ago because we were supposed to work with ARC and Mr. Larson and with Senator Vandeveer. I never got a return call. We called the Department of Human Services about 2 months ago maybe, which initiated us having to bring this bill forward because they told me in no uncertain terms we did not pursue that. And so that's why we sit here today. The other point I'd like to make is that these waivers, the waiver of age that we get is ultimately goes from the county and gets approved at the state level. It's not a county, the state can deny these waivers. It is not a give me. It is very confusing. It has confused case managers throughout the state. I have a printout of the Minnesota Help Info website that is set up by the state that describes family adult day services as a service that can serve people 55 and over as long as they have persistent mental illness or a developmental disability. I had to call it and get that corrected. It is completely confusing. That's why we need to set this straight, get rid of all the stuff in between. There's, as Mr. Kerber said, about 4,800 licensed foster care providers in the state. The problem is they all can't do family adult day services. You have to do it in the home that is your primary residence. I would like to hear the numbers on how many actual people would be able to do these programs. I believe it would probably be less than 4,800. Again, my wife and myself can have one program. It will not ever be developed into a corporate model. We can only run one individual program, which means that every program of family adult day services in the state will have its own unique family system, interests, hobbies. It can be culturally put into different neighborhoods where we have a Southeast Loate late a Vietnamese lady who wants to do what we're doing, but she wants a target specific for people in the Hmong community. She has struggled immensely to try to get started because of the confusion of these waivers. We have a public health nurse in Isani County who wanted to do what we did and was told to buzz off, quote unquote, because they didn't understand the process. And I have stories and stories and stories just like that. We should have 100 of these programs across the state now if it weren't for the confusion. Again, it is a very good, worthy choice. It's not a demand. And a lot of people aren't going to prosper in a day training and habilitation type of setting. They just need good care, a loving family, and to be integrated into the community with things to do.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. And Senator Higgins has a question, and I do want to try to see if we can move on to some of the other issues. But go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I apologize if this has already been addressed. I came in late. But there's no effective date in the bill, and it looks to me as if sections 1 and 2 should start. Section 3, the piece that tells the commissioner to seek the waiver, should be a day after final enactment, but sections 1 and 2 should be after the waiver has been granted. So I'm thinking we need to repair that. I also think that on line 4.14, where it says the commissioner shall include the family adult day services in the common services menu, there should be something at the beginning of that sentence that says after the waiver is granted, the commissioner shall. Have I interpreted that correctly?
Well,
and if so, I'll make those amendments. I guess that's the word I'm thinking of.
And, Sir Higgins, I'm not sure I would want to get advice of Council Joan, Ms. White. Sorry,
Mr. Chair, I might need assistance from Jerry Kerber, but I don't think The request for the waiver is to get Medicaid reimbursement, but that doesn't mean, I don't think that precludes Sections 1 and 2 from being effective July 1st. They just won't be able to get Medicaid reimbursement for the services.
Is that it?
Is that correct, Jerry?
That's probably the piece I missed when I wasn't here.
Thank you.
Mr.
And,
Kerber, is that right?
Mr. Kerber, did you have a comment you want to make?
Mr. Chair, Jerry Kerber again. Maybe you could repeat the question.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Kerber, do we need a different effective dates for Sections 1 and 2 than we do 3? Are Sections 1 and 2, can they be enacted only after the waiver has been granted, or can they be a date like July 1st?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I think 1 and 2 could go alone. Not everybody is getting public program funding. I think there could be some people who are private pay. And so making the changes to the licensing structure would facilitate that.
Right.
If that's answered,
I think. And Mr. Sorry, Chair, and Mr. Kerber, and that does not need the waiver?
That would not
Mr.
need
Kerber.
The waiver because
okay.
It's not federal funds paying for it.
Okay.
If it's permitted in the licensing arrangement. I might just add, too, that there is, I mean, the arrangements that we have underway now, they're, in some of those cases, it is being funded under the waivers, but this would kind of bring the whole thing out into the light of day by calling it Family Adult Day Services and billing it as Family Adult Day Services. There are many different labels you can put on a service to make it qualify for federal funding. And so this would, the whole bill in its entirety would allow for the labeling to be more consistent across the state.
And then, Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Just to clarify, Mr. Kerber, would it be useful to make Section 3 of telling the commissioner to seek the waiver effective the day after final enactment rather than July 1st? Will y'all get to it before July 1st?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I think
Mr. Kerber.
Of course, it's up to the legislature as to when you want the departments to do things. But if you wanted the department to initiate that request the day following enactment, I think that would be the appropriate way to do it rather than wait.
Maybe Senator Vandeveer, what's your preference? It's your bill. When would you like this to be done?
Mr. Chair, Council thinks it's necessary. I think applying for the waiver, we would want them to do as soon as the legislation passed, if there's a way to clarify that. Maybe Council could give us that.
Ms. White,
then, Mr. Chair, I think Senator Higgins recommended on line 4, or page 4, line 14, before the insert, after the waiver is granted,
comma,
Mr.
and then in addition to that, after line 4.16, this section is effective the day following final enactment.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, I was just reminded that the fiscal note for that waiver request anticipated that it was in the next fiscal year. And so the fiscal, if it were to be enacted, if it was a day following enactment, then that cost would be something in this fiscal year versus next fiscal year.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would just want to be certain
Senator
that
Bitter.
We were directing the department to apply to seek that waiver right away. And so whatever language corresponds with that, then I think we're okay with the rest of it.
And Ms. White, is that what this language would do to your understanding?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Recommending that the section or requiring that the section be effective the day following final enactment would mean that they needed to begin seeking that waiver after the governor signs the bill. However, as Mr. Kerber stated, the fiscal note indicates that it's a July 1st effective date. So I don't know if that will affect the fiscal note or not. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber, what's the cost to prepare and submit a waiver to the federal government?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I think I should probably turn that question over to somebody who does that work.
Okay. Hi, I'm Carrie Erber from the Department of Human Services, Continuing Care Administration. Oh, sorry. We priced the fiscal note out at $50,000, and then we had FFP of $17,500, and then there was also some systems costs. So the net cost is $34,000, and if the effective date was moved to upon enactment, we'd have to shift some of the administrative costs to fiscal year 11. It probably wouldn't be the whole thing because I imagine it would probably pass in April or so. So we'd probably have to split the cost between the two fiscal years.
All right.
We'd have to relook at that. But
right. So, Senator Higgins, are you making the motion, asking for this amendment to be adopted that was described?
Let me ask one more question, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Higgins.
And then I'll decide. Right. And I'm sorry, I didn't write down your name.
Carrie Erber.
Ms. Erber, is the amount that would move to current fiscal year absorbable, or would it have to be accounted for somehow if we move it into this fiscal year? Can the department absorb it?
Ms. Erber.
I would have to check with staff to see if that's possible. They're pretty busy at this point, too. So,
okay.
But we can get back to you on that.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I think I'll offer it. It's going to be laid over for possible inclusion, so we have a little time before your bill gets put together so that we could get that information. And if it turns out to be unworkable, we can fix it.
Right.
So I'll offer the amendment that Ms. White stated.
All right.
All dealing with page 4.
All right. Members, Senator Higgins offers the amendment to add some language, 4.14 and 4.16. Would you like to have that read again? Is it clear? Ms. White, can you just read that one more time, what the changes?
Sure. Page 4, line 14, before the, insert after the waiver is granted, comma. And page 4, after line 16, insert this section is effective the day following final enactment.
All right. That is the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Vandeveer, any other comments you'd like to make? We are prepared to lay the bill over for examination in the final bill. Possible
Thank you, inclusion. Mr. Chair. This is about competition, and that may be the rub here, but I'd like to thank the members for a very thoughtful hearing, and that's all I'd have.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think there are some problems with the local waiver thing. It sounds like it's tied up with everything. I am concerned overall that the bill may be taking away options for younger people who we should be trying to get out. I mean, I think these services are very important for older folks, but I think some of the younger ones we want to try and do, whether supportive work or whatever. I'm not sure if this bill is the right approach to dealing with the issue, though.
All right. I understand. Thank you, Senator Vandeveer, for bringing this forward. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for being here and also for the work that you're doing. We appreciate it. Is Senator Senjum? There he is, Senator Senjum. Welcome to the committee. This is Member Senate File 347. And Senator Senjum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to be somewhat brief in my comments, but before we move along, I have an A2 amendment.
All right. Senator Berglund moves the A2.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Is it the A2 or the A3? I've got an A3.
Mr. Chair, we're going to do the A2. They're essentially the same, and the A2 amendment lines up with the fiscal note. So
we don't have an A2 amendment. Just a second. We're getting it right now. So maybe, Senator Berglund, you want to wait till you see the amendment before you... Is it the same?
Chair, I think there's one word in there that's different.
One
I haven't found
different.
It yet.
All right.
But
all right. All right, members, we're looking at the A2. You have an A3 in your packet. Disregard that. And This is the A2 amendment.
Might I just add, Mr. Chair, this has to do with this bill has drawn a little controversy. One of those pieces of controversy dealt with the issue of collection of data from healthcare providers. This, in Subdivision 1, attempts to extinguish that controversy in the sense that there won't be any collection from healthcare providers that will be using currently available information.
All right. Senator Berglund moves the A2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Senator, the motion is carried. And Senator Senjum, the A2 amendment is now your bill.
Okay. Well, again, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is about Alzheimer's disease, a disease that I think in one way or another perhaps touched most of our lives. It's a disease that's relatively prevalent. 90,000 folks in Minnesota are currently, in estimate, afflicted with this. That is projected to increase on up to 200,000 by 2050 with the baby boom and so on going through. And I'm just going to kind of briefen it up in the essence of time and say this is really about trying to create a kind of a strategic approach to Alzheimer's and Alzheimer recognition, management, treatment, working within community service systems, and trying to envelop, if you will, a more kind of solid pathway in terms of dealing with this going forward. So with that, rather than get into the details, I'll let others do that. And Mary, do you want to carry on? Or is
I'm going to be
okay.
Mr.
Denny is going to carry on. He's associated with the Alzheimer's
All
group,
right.
And his wife has Alzheimer's, so he's also a family victim of this.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Chuck Denny.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm sorry, sir?
I said welcome to the committee and appreciate
you
being here.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. I am a caregiver for my wife who's had the disease for the past 16 years, the last 10 in a nursing home. I was elected chair of the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group in August of 2009, a commission that had been mandated by the state legislature. The working group was unique. It included 20 appointed members, plus experts from across the state. We had the most distinguished researchers from the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. We had clinicians from all throughout the state. We had representatives of the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Department of Health. And we even had those who live in the shadow of this disease, both caregivers and patients with the disease. We submitted 23 recommendations, which are included in a report, and that's been given out to you in your materials. We believe that we are going to be the first state, if we implement our programs, that will be totally prepared for the tsunami that Alzheimer's will become. As you are probably well aware from all the public press, the baby boomers on January 1 of this year entered into the golden retirement years, and they will be driving the increase in the number of people affected by Alzheimer's. The tragic figures will be covered later by Mary. The report that we have given to you contains five major recommendations. The first is that the disease is diagnosed early. That is critical. The second is that medical care is well managed. That means holistically. The third is that all providers meet the standards for dementia care. The fourth is that nursing home placement will be delayed if we provide strong support to family caregivers. And the last recommendation is that patients and their families have a plan for treatment as well as palliative and end-of-life care. Mary?
Mr. Chair and committee members.
And please identify yourself for the record.
Excellent. I'm Mary Burchard. I'm with the Alzheimer's Association in Minnesota, North Dakota. And it's my honor to tell you a little bit more about Alzheimer's disease so you have some basic knowledge about it. It is a brain disease that causes problems with memory, thinking, and behavior. Its symptoms usually develop slowly, and get worse over time. It's a progressive disease. And when we diagnose it, it's usually severe enough to interfere with our daily lives. It is the most common form of dementia. Dementia is not a disease. It's a category of diseases, much like cancer. And Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, accounting for 60 to 80% of the cases that we see. Alzheimer's is not a normal part of aging. This is a myth that memory loss is normal. Our risk factor goes up with age, and the majority of people with Alzheimer's disease are 65 and older. There are no survivors from Alzheimer's disease. It is a progressive, no-fault, fatal brain disease that averages 8 to 20 years in duration, and today we have no cure. It is the fifth leading cause of death in those over age 65. Each year, it kills more Americans than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. It is the only disease in the top 10 causes of death in the United States without a way to prevent it, cure it, or even slow its progression. And the chart before you and in your material shows that over the last 10 years, the percentage change of diseases that are a cause of death has dramatically increased, 66% increase in Alzheimer's deaths over the last 10 years compared to reductions in stroke, HIV, and various cancers.
The cost to caregivers is tremendous, financially, physically, and emotionally. 70% of people with Alzheimer's live at home. The caregivers are subject to immense physical and emotional stress. The disease is called the 36-hour day, and I can personally testify that that's probably an underestimate. The physical and emotional impact of caregiving takes a great toll on the physical health of the caregivers. And those costs, then, are ultimately borne in some large part by the public.
We would like to discuss with you the financial realities of Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is a very expensive disease. Older people with Alzheimer's disease have more hospital stays, more skilled nursing home stays, and utilize the home health care systems to a much greater degree. Their Medicare payments per person are almost three times higher than the average payment for other beneficiaries without dementia. One of the sad, the tragedies of Alzheimer's disease is fewer than 50% of those with the disease or other dementias ever receive a diagnosis. Delayed detection of Alzheimer's disease or delayed or even misdiagnosis deprives people of the potential benefits of planning their care and making good financial decisions. It also puts unintended strain on their caregivers. With no cure in sight, the future does hold financial devastation for those that are going to suffer Alzheimer's disease. One in eight baby boomers are in its path. Total payments for health care, long-term care, and hospice care for people with Alzheimer's and other dementias today is $183 billion. By 2050, that number approaches $1.1 trillion. The initial recommendations from the Alzheimer's Working Group that Mr. Denny chaired, there's three that really impact the bill before you. One of those recommendations is to identify Alzheimer's disease early, to communicate with medical providers the importance of and the benefits of early detection leading to the assessment of cognitive health for patients over age 65. The second important recommendation is to use the healthcare home model for improved coordination of Alzheimer's care. Today, when someone gets an Alzheimer's diagnosis, often the story is, come back in a year. I'm sorry you have Alzheimer's disease, come back in a year. There's very little coordination of their treatment or care or information provided. We believe that the healthcare home model is one answer to that. We also, in our work with the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group, believe that the state should strongly pursue cost-saving policies that we can improve care of Alzheimer's patients and save dollars if we act now. Some of those recommendations include replicating and expanding evidence-based models that have been successful at improving care and saving money in the treatment of people with Alzheimer's that have helped their caregivers. This would include policies around early detection, strong caregiver support models, and better management of the disease. We believe the state should advocate for several changes that would promote cognitive screening for Alzheimer's and make it more universally available, consistent, and reimbursable through health insurance. Senate File 347 before you has three components that we believe are very important and follow the intent of the Alzheimer's Working Group. They include reviewing current available quality measures and making recommendations for future measurement aimed at improving that screening and care related to Alzheimer's disease. This would include improving rates and results of cognitive screening, rates of Alzheimer's diagnoses, and prescribed care and treatment plans by July 1, 2012. It also includes developing a healthcare home learning collaborative curriculum that includes screening and education of best practices leading to improved identification and management of dementia patients, something that doesn't happen very often today. And finally, to review existing and forthcoming literature, research studies in particular, that estimate the differences in the outcome and cost of current practices in dementia care and focuses on areas where we think there are true cost savings, including earlier identification, better caregiver supports, and the integration of medical care with community-based services that are in existence. One thing that is really important for those of you to understand who may not have Alzheimer's in their family is that there are many faces to the disease. It is all around us. 100,000 Minnesotans are living with it today. Of those with the disease, about 4% are under age 65. That means 4,000 Minnesotans are living with the disease in their 40s and 50s. Beyond all the statistics that we've given you today, there are courageous people living with the disease, like Julie Allen.
Ms. Allen, welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. My name is Julie Allen. I'm 57 years old, and I live in the St. Anthony Village area of Minneapolis. I began my career as a cardiac care nurse and later had a successful business, a consultancy business of 12 years. 5 years ago, I began to notice problems with my memory. And on April 14th of 2010, at Health Partners Specialty Clinic, I became the fourth generation in my family with Alzheimer's. It's largely unknown that persons my age get Alzheimer's. I was just a lucky one. The diagnosis has significantly changed my life. It's changed my relationship with my family. It's taken my business away from me, and it's stolen my independence and my income. My greatest hope is that my sons and my children will never have to live with this disease. It is not what you would ask for your children. If I could ask you to remember one thing for me today, it would be the importance of diagnosing this disease early. I was very lucky, and I was diagnosed early, and as a result of that, I am functioning better than many do. With the earliest possible diagnosis, people like me can plan and prepare with my family for the days and the years ahead to come. I am doing everything that I can to be prepared, and I need you to support the Senate File 347 as a first step in preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's disease. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee, for this opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you, Ms. Allen, for being willing to come today. We appreciate your story, your testimony. Thank you. Senator Sundjom, I have on my list a few people who wanted to testify. I'm not certain. I think some of them may be wanting to raise questions about the bill. Before we do that, I did want to ask one question, and maybe counsel can help. The language of the bill refers to the commissioner on line 1.5, 1.11, 1.15. Are we talking about the Commissioner of Health?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Ms. White, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bergel.
Maybe while the other people are testifying, I could just ask Senator Senjum if you would consider an oral amendment. I won't make the amendment now. I'd just like him to think about it.
Senator Senjum, are you open to hearing an oral amendment idea?
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe that's what hearings are for. So.
We're here for the hearing. We weren't sure you were here for the hearing, or we thought you were here for the presentation. Senator Bergel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Senjum. On line 1.16, after the word develop, add or contract for the development of. And the reason I'm thinking that might be a good idea would be that this work is done a lot by ICSI, and ICSI has a lot of support from the physician community. And if they were to develop this curriculum, it might have a lot of credibility. And so I just leave that for you to think about while the other folks here testify.
All right. Thank you, Senator Berglund. I do have four names on our agenda of people who wish to testify. Is Ms. Braze. Ms. Braze. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if I could have a page.
Yes, we have someone.
Thank
you. Braze, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we're coming to oppose this bill. And my apologies to Senator Senjum because we haven't had an opportunity to tell you about our concerns. But our concerns are fivefold, and I'd like to just start out before I go into those concerns to just say that the reality of the matter is that the baby boomers are aging. And the other reality is that the biggest risk for these conditions, amongst other conditions, is the fact of aging. And we are concerned that that if this bill moves forward, it sets a precedent for gathering information, conducting research purely based on age. And there are so many other conditions as well that people are going to get when they're aging. So of our five concerns, our first concern is related to line point 1.5. Now, I hope that's correct because I actually didn't get A2. So all I have is A3, and I don't know the word that got changed in A2. Okay. All right. Well, so I think it still applies. And it's regarding the data that's currently collected by the Minnesota Department of Health. And this is a comprehensive medical record data on diagnoses, outcomes, and physician treatment plans, as the bill addresses. The reference to 62U.02 is a reference to the payment reform law passed in 2008, which is discussed for you on this card here, this one that says no such thing as privacy. And you'll note in the back it describes the law that got passed and the data that's collected. Doctors must submit data to the government, which will be used to provide bonuses or financial penalties to providers. This data is collected through a multi-million dollar contract with a data warehouse in Maine and the Minnesota Community Measurement, which accesses private claims data that is sent to the warehouse without patient consent on all patients in Minnesota. And there are two points I'd like to make about this current collection of data. And if you'll notice in lines 1.11, to 1.14, the likelihood is that this will be which was in the first part of the bill, which is the Minnesota Community Measurement. It says a private entity already under contract through Section 62U.02. Okay, so the two points about this collection is, number one, the issue of personal autonomy and individual control over medical decisions. The name of this database is the All-Payer Claims Database. The state is using patient data in this database to create scorecards on doctors and hospitals without the consent of patients. The first ones came out in November. The scores are determined by the doctors or the hospital's compliance with the government-issued treatment directives or patient outcomes as determined by the government. The scores are then tied to payment reform. Eventually, this system will lead, we believe, to universal one-size-fits-all treatment decisions as preferred and issued by the state government. Number two, there's the issue of privacy. I'd like to mention that this database, that oftentimes this database is talked about as though it protects privacy because there is certain information that is not collected. However, even the Secretary of Health and Human Services notes in the HIPAA rule that such collection does not mean that the data is unidentifiable. So we're talking autonomy and privacy for the database that is being discussed and the collection that's being discussed in the in Subdivision 1. Our second concern is that this is research being conducted by the state government without the consent of the research subjects whose data is being taken and used for purposes which they know nothing about and which they might not agree with. Alzheimer's patients are especially vulnerable. Where private research institutions may be seeking to create new treatments for patients, the state is a payer, likely with an eye toward cost containment. This places the state in a conflict of interest with the patients. We foresee the possibility that this data combined with financial incentives under the payment reform, plus the gatekeeper function of healthcare homes and the government's development of so-called best practices for identification and treatment, will lead to rationing of healthcare services for some of our most vulnerable citizens. Our third concern is the database itself. On this card, we show you a list of plenty of the government databases already in place in Minnesota, including the Cancer Registry, the Birth Defects Registry, and the Trauma Registry. And all of these are being collected information on individuals without their consent. It's clear to me that we should be eliminating government databases on the people of Minnesota, including the taxpayer expense of funding them, not expanding the reach and purposes of the databases we already have. Our fourth and final concern is the early identification of Alzheimer's. The department's report says that the cognitive health of all Medicare patients should be assessed at an annual wellness visit now offered under Obamacare, which, as you may know, is cutting $500 billion from Medicare just as 77 million baby boomers begin to enter. This, we believe, is a clear sign of rationing to come. Keep in mind that some people may not want to have their cognition assessed, and they may or may not know that's what's being done. In addition, the American Medical News reports that screening for dementia is controversial, with a high risk of false positives, as well as stigma for positive test results. So let me conclude by saying that we understand that Alzheimer's disease is a difficult and disabling condition, but that is not sufficient rationale to expand surveillance on the elderly population. If patients with Alzheimer's disease want to become part of a research study, they can make themselves available to those who are looking for cures. It is not a good idea, we believe, to give their data to those who have the power to use their data to tie doctors' hands and ration care.
Thank you, Ms. Braze. And members, we are running up against our session time. I do want to invite very briefly, if Drs. Gehring Geist and Mr. Tyler are here, we're not going to be able to allow you to read your entire statement. We've got some information here, but if you would be willing to come forward and very briefly make some summary comments. I assume you're opposing the bill, but perhaps you could express that briefly. And otherwise, I'm afraid I'd have to invite you to come back at 6 o'clock tonight. And if you're willing to do that, we can let you speak more at length at that time. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Senator Hahn, committee, I'm sorry, I couldn't really understand what you said.
All right.
I need to tune them up a bit. I'm very sorry about that. I just saw the amendment put out today.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Sure.
My comment was that you'll need to be very brief, that we only have a couple of minutes.
Believe me. The amendment, it makes it very brief.
All right. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Robert Geist.
Thanks.
Excuse me. I'm now retired and a patient and over 65. My personal history is I've held many offices in medicine, but I enjoyed my practice. I did not run up against many Alzheimer's patients, a few. Unfortunately, in my family, my younger sister has dementia, and my older sister, age 91, doesn't. Can't explain that. So I'm quite aware of the problem, and I'd like to congratulate Senator Sinjum and also the people who just gave your presentation from the Alzheimer's Committee. I was most impressed with that. And I'm not here to oppose this bill. I'm just saying it can be fixed. And I think the amendment really does that. On the handout I gave out, it was mostly addressed to what I read last night in the bill, not the amendment. And I think the amendment takes care of the problems I have. Basically, when you ask for outcomes, which is a quality measure, and cost, you're talking about a report card. And when it comes to report cards, we got problems. They ought to be accurate. They're inaccurate. This is worse than no report at all. I think you're all familiar with the pitfalls of report cards, and people, clinics will dodge sick patients and so forth. But I think you have to have risk adjustment, and you have to have attribution, and these are neither done. Now, this is important for the future of this bill, because I think if the investment is going to be in a academic assessment of what you need to do to gather the information you're getting and then to expand it out into all the clinics so that all Minnesotans get a proper assessment, that's a great goal. But you have to remember that report cards always sound like something threatening to clinicians, and that they always worry if they're going to ask me to do this, and you want the data collected and reported, fine, but that takes up my time and my clinic costs go up. You, in the original bill, you allowed for the cost of the analysis but not of the collection of data. I do think the amendment takes care of that. So in final summary, I would just say that I think if you invest, as the amendment says, into a way of doing this well, then you're going to make real progress. From that, you can expand out, like you would with any other public health program, into the population and into all the providers. In other words, I think you're on the right track, and I think it can be fixed, and I think you're fixing it. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. And I don't see the other folks on the list who are here. And members, if you're tolerant of a minute, we could take the amendment that Senator Berglund has offered and ask Senator Senjum if he's open to that amendment.
I do support your bill, Senator Senjum, and whether you accept my amendment or not. But
Senator Senjum?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I think that's a reasonable piece of language, and I would certainly accept that.
All right. I would
Senator Berglund moves to insert on line 1.16 after develop or contract for the development of.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. And members, if you have other questions, I would invite Senator Senjum to return to our committee at 7 p.m. Otherwise, I would lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Any other questions?
It's a good bill.
Good bill. If not, then we are recessed until 7 tonight. Thank you.
7?
7 o'clock tonight.